evaluations on the presentations that you've heard. So next up we have Dan Nall with Cisco Hennessy. Dan is a ASHRAE AIA and lead fellow. He is the regional director of high performance solutions and has served on many, many, many guides. Yes? Okay. Dan's expertise on the guides, especially with HVAC and on the architecture side and bringing those together. So we'll let him wrap up here.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
So you've seen, you've seen these learning objectives. So when we look at a roadmap for integrated design for energy efficiency, it's pretty well acknowledged that the path shown here is the way to go. So the first thing that you're doing is you're reducing the heating and cooling loads with the architecture and the program. You're utilizing your environmental resources that are available, such as daylighting and natural free cooling. Then after you've done that, you improve the efficiency of your active systems by optimizing the HVAC systems and the lighting systems. And then finally, when all of that's done and you've reached the lowest EUI that you can achieve, it's at that point that you bring in your renewable energy resources. So on the HVAC side, how do we go about doing that level of optimization? We need to pay attention to maximizing both full and part load efficiency, realizing that most HVAC systems operate at full capacity less than 5% of the time. We need to, in many climates, utilize demand control ventilation. Ventilate the people rather than the spaces, because bringing in an inordinate amount of outdoor air, if you're in Anchorage, Alaska in the wintertime, or you're in Miami, Florida in the summertime, can consume a very large amount of energy. We need to separate the ventilation, dehumidification, and temperature control. Many HVAC systems have one knob that you turn. It's on the wall, and nominally it controls the temperature, but it also likely controls the dehumidification and the amount of outdoor air that's being delivered, especially in the case of a mixed air VAV system. Obviously, all of those parameters are not being controlled in an optimum manner for either human comfort, health, or energy conservation. So separating those functions really makes a lot of sense. Interestingly, there's a real strong correlation between the amount of dehumidification that's required and the amount of ventilation air that's required, because in most spaces, especially schools, with the exception, let's say, of the cafeteria, the dehumidification load is primarily a function of the number of people that are in there. And the more people that are in there, the more ventilation air that you need. So if you utilize your ventilation airflow to provide most of your dehumidification, then actually you wind up controlling quite well with only two knobs and not three. Air-to-air heat recovery or energy recovery is very much a component of energy-efficient school design. One of the things that we learned early on is that when we meet the peak ventilation requirements per ASHRAE 62.1, that we are actually providing enough air that we can likely meet the actual peak cooling load with that amount of airflow. So one of the decisions that was made early on in terms of looking at systems is that we could look at systems with a dedicated outdoor air system with energy recovery, and then our conditioning systems within the space could be entirely recirculating, realizing that those entirely recirculating systems have no economizer cycle, but also realizing that the flow rate required for outdoor air would meet your cooling loads during those periods of time when, in fact, the outdoor conditions had a low enough enthalpy that that they would be beneficial for free cooling. You also need to look at your transport energy to look at transporting heat within the building using refrigerant or water rather than air. And so that then tied in with this idea of local recirculating systems, whereby the cooling would be conveyed from wherever it was being produced to the space through refrigerant flow or water flow, and then the air delivery pathway would be significantly reduced in the amount of energy that would be consumed in moving the heat or cool from the terminal device into the space would be minimized. I mentioned exploiting our natural conditioning sources and how in a school building, just providing the ventilation air provides the most of the capacity that you would need for natural free cooling. Pay attention to conditioning the people and not the spaces. Few K-12 schools will have spaces high enough that stratification can make a difference, but perhaps a gym might be such a space. So looking at where the people are, where the players are on the court, where the audience is, and applying ventilation applying both ventilation and conditioning resources at that location rather than high in the space where there are no people is going to make sense and ultimately save energy. Eliminate reheat. When spaces require humidity control, the most common approach, unfortunately, oftentimes is just to apply reheat. Apply full cooling and then keep the temperature within bounds with reheat. So that is not consistent with producing a zero energy school. And so the strategy is to look at how you can maintain your humidity control without doing reheat. You need to right size your systems furthermore. Systems that are too large often operate inefficiently, sometimes cycle, and if they cycle, then you lose dehumidification capacity during those times when they are off. And so in order to achieve that right sizing, there's a process that you go through, and that process does not involve doing, you know, calculations out to a number of decimal points past the, or number of places past the decimal point, getting a number and then applying a 25% safety factor. That's not the way you do it. So really a much more scientific approach is to understand what you think the values are, understand your uncertainty with respect to what those values are, and use those uncertainty factors to provide your safety factor rather than just applying a blanket factor. So here's an example of our separation of ventilation dehumidification from our sensible heating and cooling. And we have our dedicated outdoor air system with our energy recovery wheel. And in this case, we have a chill water, hot water recirculating fan coil. So there are standards for performance for all of these different types of systems, and basically in this document for determining the performance of the components that we applied to the prototypes to meet our goals, we in general followed the requirements for ASHRAE standard 189.1/2017, and those provided us with adequate efficiency to meet the goals we're trying to achieve. And furthermore, those particular performance parameters meet one of the primary requirements for this document, which that there be in the marketplace at least two products that can meet that level of performance. So here we see our variable refrigerant flow system. We tested two types of systems for the schools. One was a water source variable refrigerant flow system that was ground coupled, and the other was an air source variable refrigerant flow system. And there are, of course, standards for performance for those systems. And here we have an example or an image of the piles being drilled for ground-coupled vertical closed-loop system. One thing I should mention is that one of the challenges also oftentimes with ground-coupled systems is getting a balance between the annual heat rejection into the ground when the building is in the cooling mode and the annual heat extraction from the ground when the building is in the heating mode. And throughout most of the United States, that balance is going to be toward an excess amount of heat rejected into the ground. Because when you think about it, when you're rejecting the heat into the ground, not only are you rejecting the heat that is you're extracting from the building, but you're also rejecting the heat of the compressor. Now, when your building is in the heating mode, on the other hand, the amount of heat that you're extracting from the ground is equal to the heating load in the building less the compressor heat, because the compressor heat is then going into the building. And so what you find, you have to get pretty far north before you get this balance moving more toward the being weighted on the heat extraction side. So one of the strategies that you can use to overcome that balance, in fact, is to utilize water-to-water heat pump water heaters to serve your service hot water needs in the kitchen, and that will serve to help balance that problem with the heat balance with the ground. And of course, there are performance requirements that we used for these various pieces of VRF water source and ground source heat pump equipment. Another system that needs a lot of attention in K-12 schools, excuse me, is service water heating. Although, one of the things that I learned is that the service water heating requirement in modern higher or middle and high school buildings is not as great as it used to be when I was in high school. It seems that the camera-equipped cell phone has rendered taking showers after physical education an untenable activity. So many of these schools are now furnished actually without showers. And so the only large-scale service water heating need then for the building, it's no longer the locker room with all the showers, but it's just the kitchen. So if we have heat recovery or heat pump or large gas-fired tank-type systems for our kitchen, we need to use those in concert with much smaller, often electric-resistance heaters with small tanks for our distributed small uses, hand wash sinks and things like that. And the reason for that is because in order to get quick delivery of hot water at these remote small uses, we have to use a pump recirculation system. And actually, the heat loss from those pipes over time, which are kept charged with hot water, is actually much greater than the amount of heat that's used with actually people washing their hands. So even though you could make an argument that using electric resistance for water heating is a sort of an entropic crime. On the other hand, if you look at the alternative and keeping a very long heat exchanger, the hot water pipe, hot continuously, that's probably a worse crime. As I mentioned, avoid recirculation pumps, insulate the hot water pipe, utilize water sense appliances, and in the case of the dishwashing, consider chemical sanitization as a way to enable a reduced temperature, like 140 degrees Fahrenheit, for sanitization of your kitchen utensils as opposed to much hotter 180 degree water. Another strategy for minimizing your service water heating energy requirements is to utilize a heat recovery from the commercial refrigeration in the kitchen to preheat the domestic hot water. They're de-superheating heat exchangers that actually can be put right onto the compressorized units of the commercial refrigeration system that recover that heat from any commercial refrigeration product and put that heat into the service water heater tank. Most of these K-12 schools have packaged commercial refrigeration equipment. They'll be packaged, perhaps walk-in freezers or coolers. Sometimes it might only be reach-in freezers and coolers. But if you are buying the larger equipment, the walk-in devices, it's important to specify that they come equipped with electronically commutated motor, condenser, and evaporator fans, that they are equipped with floating head pressure and variable set point control to maximize the part load efficiency. You want to maximize the insulation for your walk-in and your reach-in cooler and freezer boxes. Specify automatic door closers and effective door seals for the walk-ins. And in the case of site-built boxes, to maximize the floor insulation. And here's some examples of an automatic door closer and a highly insulated walk-in box, along with a detail for how you configure the floor underneath a site-built walk-in freezer box. And those are all included in the guide. Then we turn to the kitchen equipment, and once again, it's kind of the same story. You want to, in the kitchen, heat the food and not the room, and too often, that's not the case. So you want to maximize the capture of the heat and emissions from your cooking activity by the proper location of the cooking appliances underneath the hoods. You know, you want the hoods well placed so that all the stuff that's coming up out of the off the cooking surface goes directly into the hood. That will enable you to minimize the amount of exhaust that's used to treat a particular cooking activity. In the case of Discovery Schools, they use convection combi ovens with highly insulated cabinets. These are a piece of equipment that can, they can bake, they can steam. John, what else can they do? They have several different modes of operation all in a cabinet. But what's important is that the cooking's going on inside a cabinet, not out in the open air. If you are using something like tureens for making soup or stew, they need to be directly heated and insulated, not a big pot sitting on top of a gas-fired flame on a cooktop. Another technology that's coming into use are inductive cooktops, and these work by inducing electrical currents in metallic cooking vessels that sit on top of them. And the cooktops themselves aren't hot. They just have electric coils underneath them. And those electric coils don't actually consume much energy until they interact electromagnetically with a conductor that's sitting on top of them. But once again,
there needs to be some intelligence applied to the use of this technology. If you've got an inductive cooktop with a great big pan and a little bitty piece of food in the middle, you're still heating the room and not the food. So basically, use the inductive cooktops with small pans that are sized for the amount of food that you're actually cooking at that point in time. Using warming tables with recirculating water, no open grills, no open deep fat fryers, no gas-fired or electric-resistant cooktops. Remembering that less heat and smoke in the cooking process means less exhaust and less makeup airflow. And here's these are pictures of your kitchen, aren't they, John? Yeah. So very tidy installation, I think we could say. Renewable energy systems. One of the things that you need to remember, and this ties back even to the title of the publication, the ADDG does not contain a comprehensive renewable energy systems design guide. Okay? We give some pointers, some advice as to how to configure the building, customize the building, make it amenable to the application of renewable energy systems with respect to the roof and with respect to the electrical distribution system, things like that. But it is not a design guide. So we don't give you sizing criteria that say, do this size PV system oriented in this direction, and guess what? You've got net zero energy. So that's why we call it the zero energy design guide, because basically we're going to get you to an EUI that's so low that if you go to another guide that tells you how to adequately and competently design and size your photovoltaic system, you're there at net zero. So basically, we do point out that you should size your array based upon this optimized building EUI. Configure the roof for warranty-sensitive installation of photovoltaic panels. You don't want your roofing contractor to come back and say, oh, you put that on my roof, the leak that you got's not under the warranty. You want to locate the panels for best orientation and avoidance of shadowing. I think a lot of mechanical engineers aren't aware of just how sensitive photovoltaic arrays are to shadowing. The way that many photovoltaic arrays are configured is you have a number of modules in series, and then though that's called a string, and you put the strings together in parallel. What happens, you get a little bit of shadowing on one of the modules in a string, you pretty much effectively knock the entire string out. So self-shadowing is a really big thing. Now, there are ways around that which are beyond the scope of this discussion, but in any event, you don't know yet at this point what your photovoltaic array is going to be like. So basically, you want to look at your roof and how your photovoltaic array might be configured without the danger of shadowing. Configure the electrical distribution system to accept the power input from the PV system. As John pointed out, it's important to negotiate the power contract with the electric utility, and perhaps you ought to anticipate some unanticipated factors that might reduce the production of your PV array. I think most people find that their PV array always turns out a little bit less than maybe they originally calculated it. And this is an example of a nicely laid out a PV array on a roof. And that's my story. So now we have time for burning questions for my presentation, or non-burning questions for anybody.
Graham Lynn, Sustainable Engineering Group. I'm curious about makeup air. Are there any heat recovery options that you've seen for makeup air in the kitchens, or is that tough?
Yeah, I've been asked that question before, and perhaps with a kitchen like John's, which has very little grease production, you might well
think about doing some kind of runaround coil or something like that. But and there are some products out there that have runaround coils that have kind of a washdown cycle or something like that. But my own personal feeling is I wouldn't specify anything like that for any kind of cooking activity that I think is going to have a lot of grease, because there's too much opportunity for something to fail, and something fails, you know, my fault, your fault, nobody's fault, I'm probably going to get sued. So, you know, I'll just stay away from that one.
Hi, Jose Candanedo, Natural Resources Canada. Ourselves, we're working on some school projects, on school boards in the region of Montreal, and thank you all for the very interesting presentations. I was wondering if you could comment on three things, a question for the panel. First, about the role of an integrated design process, because when you're designing a school, there's often conflicting needs. For example, if you increase daylighting, you have bigger windows, that tends to affect the insulation. Secondly, if the particular needs of cold climates, it is probably harder to design. It is harder to design a net zero school for a climate, say, in Minnesota as opposed to California, for instance. And if you could comment on the role of the demand response for schools, you can achieve a school that is net zero over the annual energy balance while still having a very high peak demand, electric demand in the mornings, because you are generating later at noon when your PV system is going to be producing at its maximum output. So, thank you.
So that's a lot of words. So could you do me the favor, or do us all the favor, of doing one question at a time? So what was the first question?
The integrated design, the role of bringing together all the engineers, the mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, the lighting experts, etc., early on.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of the things we actually talk about in the guide, that you may, as an owner, we may spend a bit more money on that, but it's, you know, you get a gain and you save in the end. So, yes, you probably are going to have to pay a bit more for fees, and you're certainly going to pay more for all of the, we paid more for all the commissioning that we did and the verification. But in the end, I think we balanced it out and managed it within the budget that we had.
Second one was about cold climate. If you have any tips for cold climate design?
Move.
Cold climates were really tough. Cold climates, there's only so much insulation that you can put on a building. It's true. And I would say that, you know, Anchorage, Alaska, and Duluth were were our two most challenging locations in terms of trying to meet our performance goals.
Although you can get bigger energy savings, the challenge comes is, can you get the EUI down to the point that renewable resources, and in particular photovoltaics, can work in places like Fairbanks, yeah, where there's just no solar resource. You know, that's where the tough part is. But you can certainly hit the EUI targets that we've talked about and make a substantial difference in how that building uses energy. But In all of these climates, you know, even getting down into Chicago, you know, the envelope becomes much more important. And there's a discussion in there about envelope performance testing. So not only getting the amount of insulation right, but making sure that is properly tight and that you're bringing in appropriate ventilation where you need to, is very important.
So the solution in Anchorage is to actually put a sawmill on site and burn the sawdust.
Yes, well, and the final question was about demand response. Like, if you are also considering, like, how to manage the loads in the school, I don't know how, it depends, I guess, on the jurisdiction. You have different electricity rates, but sometimes they have very heavy penalties for demand charges. So maybe you could comment on that.
So you can design, with those rates in mind, right? And a lot of it has to do with how much how you distribute load. You know, one of the advantages on, like, the ground source heat pumps is that you can stage them. They're really relying more on ground temperature than outside temperature as that heat discharge or heat sink. So you can manage those peaks in a lot of ways with that. It all comes down to how much storage you might add to that, right? So if you're, You know, if you know all the lights are going to come on at 6 o'clock in the morning to start a day, you don't want to have all your heat pumps coming on at the exact same time, right? And one of the things we do see is these, you know, early morning peaks, but you can manage that with the, you know, the energy management system piece.
So many demand response systems are organized around what I would call managed curtailment. So basically, I know when I worked on a major newspaper headquarters in New York City, there were systems there that recognized that we could raise the temperature 2 degrees during a demand response event. We could we were delivering more outdoor air than required, but we could reduce that down to the minimum. The daylight responsive lighting controls were designed at that point probably to more than 30-foot candles at the work surface, probably closer to 35 or 40, but they recognized they could reduce them down to 35. However, following what John said, that type of curtailment, that type of compromise of the environment in what a place that's dedicated to pedagogy probably is not appropriate.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the interesting presentations.
Hi, very interesting talks, and I apologize for missing the first half, so maybe this was covered, but Mr. Nall, in your last slide you brought up the issue of uncertainty around generation, so I was wondering, what's your experience been with the uncertainty around loads from the design to the operation phase?
So the question I think was the uncertainty in the generation. I wouldn't necessarily call it uncertainty of the generation. I would say that when you're doing design around the generation side, you have to make sure you account for things like, you know, my solar panels at my house just spent 3 weeks under snow, right? And so things like that, if you're trying to match it. Now, things like any piece of design, and I think one of the things we don't think about enough with zero energy is if you really want to be zero, you need a little bit more generation, because the generation will never do as well as you think it's going to, and that the chances are, although John is definitely an exception and a good model here, typically the loads are going to be a little higher than you predict. And so from an engineering point of view, you want to give yourself some margin, you know, for that. One of the nice things about these and having the models, and one of the things that the committee felt that modeling was very important here, is having a good as-built model of the building that works with the building, that you can show performs, identifies where these problem areas are, right? And if your building is performing above what the model says, go and look at what's going on in the building, right? And the first step is, did the model actually match what the building, you know, does the model match the as-built condition? So, you know, that's where the uncertainty comes, right? In saying, are the two going to match? And if they don't match, we've got an issue. Some piece of equipment isn't working right. It's a commissioning issue. John talked about the value of that commissioning. And I think you can get that uncertainty way down.
So as an example of one of these kinds of phenomena, many, many years ago, I was a systems integrator for the photovoltaics system that was on top of the 1996 Olympic swimming and diving venue in Atlanta. At the time, for just a brief moment, it was the largest building-mounted photovoltaic array in the world for about 2 weeks, I think. But it consistently turned out about 1 or 2% less power at any point in time than the very best modeling tools indicated. And so ultimately, we figured out what it was. These photovoltaic modules were mounted on top of a standing seam metal roof, and this had been modeled to look at the heat loss from the module based upon its separation from the roof and airflow and all that kind of stuff. And it turned out that the thermal model that had been used had assumed that the emissivity of the roof underneath the photovoltaic module was what would be for a normal roofing material, which would be 0.9. But this was a standing seam metal roof with a emissivity of about 0.1 or 0.2, so that heat loss off the back of the photovoltaic module was less than would had been anticipated in the model. Thus, the PV panel was operating a degree or two warmer in any given condition than the model said, and thus was putting out less electricity.
Okay, neat. Thank you.
Thank you. Paulson, Advanced Building Performance, Washington, D.C. I have three quick questions. First is for Shannon. This may be a philosophical question. So I've been told for school design that 3,500 is best or lower Kelvin would be best for elementary school because they tend to be hyperactive and you want warmer lamp temperature to calm them down, whereas in high school application, you want them to be towards daylight, 5,000 or higher Kelvin, to make them awake because they don't have enough sleep, most of them. Do you have some philosophical preference with that?
I don't know if I have a philosophical preference, but there are a variety of studies which look at lighting for circadian rhythms, for example, where you are tuning the Kelvin temperature, and some of those are showing that potentially a cooler Kelvin temperature may increase focus, and warmer color temperatures may make people feel more comfortable and calm them down. I tend to go towards more of a neutral 3,500 to 4,000 as a balance in there if we're looking at static white, because certainly there's times you want kids to calm down and there's times that you want them to focus. And so I look for the balance in between.
Thank you. And second is, I noticed the absence of mentioning about radiant floor application in net zero schools, because especially for elementary school application, K2, maybe third grade, most of the kids spend their day on the floor. And I found when you have a floor that's warm enough for them to sit on the tush, it's much better for them. And I'm just curious, Paul, maybe you have some comments on why was that not included in the Advanced Building Design Guide?
So, you know, again, the book is not all of the solutions, and so you bring up, you know, definitely a solution that is very viable. You know, it's really about meeting the targets. I think radiant floors are a good idea for the reasons that you've suggested. You know, so we can't solve all the problems. John, do you want to address that as an owner?
Yeah, I would say that is something we do grapple with, and it's something we thought about a lot in the past. A rug is a good solution to that.
One last question. Did you guys deal with the persistence of performance at all in any of the studies in writing the guides? I mean, how long does that performance sustain with the net zero buildings you have at schools?
So one of it is it's very new. I think John's story, and I'll ask him to say this again, you know, is really about how well can you maintain the building? How simple are the systems? And that is really the key to make this work. And John, you want to say a word about that? And then it is after 3, so we will wrap the session up.
Okay. So, it really is about how we maintain them. And we've maintained it for 2 years now, and we've managed to keep our zero energy and have a healthy excess generation, which we're now, as I said, trying to get through the legislature so that we can actually keep it. I don't think we know until we've been doing it for some years.
You gave us a lot in your presentation, so what we can give you is that compliments to all of you. You should keep presenting this maybe once in a year for the next 6 years or so. No, but let me ask you one thing. In case some of you happen to use PV, most of the time you use PV panels to supply the energy source. And are there any occasions where you use wind turbines or wind power or something?
Well, yes, certainly you could do that in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. There are some issues with wind turbines. I don't want a school anywhere near a wind turbine
I see.
Because of the danger of failure. But certainly you can only use that in parts of the country where there's sufficient wind.
Yeah, I see.
So I would want the wind turbine to be some distance from the school so there was no danger that the blades would come.
That's right, for a community or so. Let me ask why I had some suggestion. The biofuels in form of the wooden pellets with using gasifiers is another source of energy that is not what you call investigated thoroughly. In the future, maybe you should address that. You know, they are quite a bit. They can guarantee a clean energy source all the time, all the places.
So one of the things that we did want to respect on the definition, and so, you know, we are somewhat agnostic to how those sources are. Again, really the target of this guide is zero energy ready. What kind of EUI target can you hit? One of the important pieces is having that resource on site. In order to match the definition that we use. One of the things on the wind is that the scale of most wind turbines now would far exceed, and again, they tend to be going, you know, that industry tends to be going to large-scale wind farms. We have seen some examples using biofuels.
Yes.
You know, the question is that harvested and grown on-site, and is that a sustainable resource? You know, in some cases. In many cases, it is a renewable resource, but it is trucked from somewhere else.
Yes.
And that is very similar to saying, oh, I've got a wind turbine that is somewhere else and I'm transporting wind energy to my building. And so, you know, that's one of the things there. But we actually have seen some case studies around zero energy buildings where the wood energy is grown and harvested sustainably on site, you know, for that location. Yes. And it does work, especially in a lot of these northern remote you know, environments.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Quick question, Jeff?
No.
No?
Yeah,
I think people are ready to go home.
I think I'll email you.
Okay. That would be great.
So please don't forget to fill out the evaluation forms online.